I hope you've got a photocopy, a single A4 sheet, a photocopy of a couple of chapters from the first book in the Bible, the book of Genesis. It'd be helpful if you could have that somewhere where you can see it. In a moment I'm going to read you from that a story. But I want to explain why beforehand. I don't know if you've read Douglas Coupland's first book, Generation X. Have you read that? It's a bit passé now. It's published about 9 years ago. Has anyone read it? It's interesting. It's a good read, in a funny kind of way. Let me read you just a little bit that one of the characters says. There are three characters, and they've gone out to the desert to tell stories, to tell their stories to one another. And one of the characters, called Claire, says that it's not healthy to live life as a succession of isolated little cool moments. Either our lives become stories, or there's just no way to get through them. That's a perceptive comment, that our lives are stories. We have pasts and futures. But the question I want to ask is there any story, with a capital S, which somehow makes sense of our stories, which stands above them and makes sense of them? Our culture says no. I don't know if you went into Waterstones in March. They had a display, a book sale, of what they call the best inspirational writing. Did anybody see this? Let me tell you some of the books they had on display. This was inspirational religious writing. You could buy Jonathan Livingston Seagull, Buddhism Without Beliefs, The Tao of Physics, The Art of Dreaming, Principles of Wicca, Women Who Run with the Wolves, very intriguing. The Tao of Pooh and the Tea of Piglet, Buddha's Little Instruction Book. And then there was C.S. Lewis's book, Mere Christianity, sandwiched in between Feng Shui for the Soul and Jeet Kune Do by Bruce Lee. And the publisher's blurb said that this was an exotic and rich gathering of books. We don't necessarily promise you enlightenment. However, we are sure that whatever your interest, meditation or prayer, fire walking or kung fu, yogic flying or shamanic drumming, you will find something to suit your personality. Well, that's it, isn't it? That's our age. No story that stands above our stories with a capital S, no story that's true and that we can refer to as God's story. In the jargon, no meta-narrative, no narrative that stands above and beyond ours. But there is, and I want to read us part of it that you've got on your sheets in a moment, God's story. Genesis, I'd love to read chapter 1, but we've got chapters 2 and 3 tonight. Somebody's bound to be thinking, oh, come off it, we are intelligent people. Some of us are scientists, treat us with respect. You can't read Genesis seriously to a bunch of Cambridge students nowadays. Well, I want to say, please don't close your ears, anybody, if you're a scientist. A lot of folk in our church are scientists. Some of them are quite good scientists. The professor of geophysics at this university, I'm told, is quite a good scientist. And he believes that this story is the true story of human beginnings, God's way of telling us what we need to know. It's not a scientific story. It's not written in the way we usually write science. In fact, I mean, we know a great deal more science than the human being who first wrote this down. But if we don't listen to his story, we know a great deal less truth. And so I want to say, let's take this story from Genesis on its own terms and listen to it, because it's God's story of human beginnings. Well, someone else says, hang on a minute. Surely this stuff in the early chapters of Genesis, there were lots of creation myths around, weren't there, in different cultures? Oh, there were. You can look them up in the libraries from other places in the ancient Near East. There were. But there's a very important difference. And it's the kind of question that's answered. Just supposing you go to the arts theatre and you get there slightly late, but they let you in. And you sit down to the person in the next door seat and you say to them, look, what's the play about? Or how did the play begin? Well, there are two kinds of answers they could give you. They would probably say something like, well, to start with, three witches came in, and then there was a scene between an old king and a wounded soldier. That's one kind of answer to how the play began. But it might be that you were asking a different question, and that you were asking, the question, how did the play originate? Did it write itself? Do the actors make it up as they go along? Or is there someone who's not on the stage, not like the people on the stage, someone we can't see, who invented it and caused it to be? Do you see that's a different kind of question to ask of the play? And the creation myths of pagan religions answer the first kind of question. There's always a bunch of people and gods and so on sort of there, as it were, on stage. And they just tell stories about what they did at the early stages of the story, as they say. But Genesis answers the question, is there somebody off stage who wrote it? And therefore it's worth listening to that. Now, I didn't understand all the stuff in Genesis 1 and 2 and 3, and I'm sure there may be things some of you want to discuss afterwards. All I can hope to do is to read it to you and to pause from time to time just to try to highlight some of the significance of it. So I'm going to start with chapter 2, verse 4, which is near the top on the left-hand side of your sheets. This is the account of the heavens and the earth when they were created. When the Lord God made the earth and the heavens, and no shrub of the field had yet appeared on the earth, and no plant of the field had yet sprung up, for the Lord God had not sent rain on the earth, and there was no man to work the ground, but streams came up from the earth and watered the whole surface of the ground. The Lord God formed the man from the dust of the ground and breathed into his nostrils the breath of life, and the man became a living being. Now the Lord God had planted a garden in the east in Eden, and there he put the man he had formed. And the Lord God made all kinds of trees grow out of the ground, trees that were pleasing to the eye and good for food. In the middle of the garden were the tree of life and the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. And then verses 10, 11, 12, 13, 14 are about the rivers. And then verse 15, the Lord God took the man and put him in the garden of Eden to work it and take care of it. I'm just going to pause there for a moment. Taking the story on its own terms, what kind of creature is man? And the answer is, man is a creature with tremendous dignity. Here is God's garden, he's got his garden, but he doesn't look after it directly himself. He says it needs a gardener. And who's going to be the gardener? Well, it's not the dogs and the cats and the lions. God's gardener is man. You may know the story of the gardener working, digging up weeds in his front garden, and a pious old lady admires it over the fence. And she says to him, how lovely to see the beauty of what God has made. To which the sweating old man replies, you should have seen it when God had it to himself. That's the point of Genesis 2, isn't it? God has chosen to give the care of his world to human beings. Some years ago, a British film director called Duncan Gibbons visited Alaska. And he loved it, and he wrote to a friend later, one had a feeling of how life was at the beginning of time when the animals ruled and we bowed in their presence. That is precisely wrong. Man is given the dignity to care for God's world, and it is man's job to make sure that God's world is properly ordered, that it's a place of growth rather than sterility and life rather than death. That's what it is to be a human being. And with that dignity, which means that work makes sense, that the purposefulness of human work makes sense in that context, with that goes responsibility. Let's read the next couple of verses, verse 16 and 17. The Lord God commanded the man, you're free to eat from any tree in the garden, but you must not eat from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, for when you eat of it, you will surely die. And that's human responsibility. The point is that we're not to rule alone. We're not to say, well, I'm in charge, in the words of the poet Swinburne, glory to man in the highest, for man is the master of things. We're not to do that. We're to be responsible and accountable to the Creator. And he gives us freedom, and he gives us commands, so that decisions matter. What we do in life matters. I wonder if you admit that. that you ought to, if you're a human being, you ought to love God and obey him. That's the moral obligation of every human being. Doesn't matter what they call themselves in terms of belief, every human being ought to love God, and it's a scandal if we don't. So there's dignity and there's responsibility. And then what happens next is just brilliant. Verse 18. The Lord God, some of you will probably choose to have this read at your weddings, and I wouldn't blame you. The Lord God said, "It is not good for the man to be alone. I will make a helper suitable for him." Now that doesn't mean that poor old Adam is lonely. People sometimes read that and say, oh, poor old Adam was lonely, the cats and the dogs weren't good enough company, he needed something better. What it means in this context is that God has given him this whopping great garden to look after, and he can't do it on his own. So he needs a helper fit for him. So what kind of helper is he going to get? Well, let's read on, verse 19. The Lord God had formed out of the ground all the beasts of the field and all the birds of the air. He brought them to the man to see what he would name them. And whatever the man called each living creature, that was its name. So the man gave names to all the livestock and so on. But for Adam, no suitable helper was found. So the Lord God caused the man to fall into a deep sleep. And while he was sleeping, he took one of the man's ribs and closed up the place with flesh. And the Lord God made a woman from the rib he had taken out of the man, and he brought her to the man. That's not a description of a kind that you'd see in the British Medical Journal. It's not true in that sense, but it is true. And when the man sees the woman, he's very, very pleased. And the whole chemistry of sexual attraction, of desire and delight, begins, God's idea. In verse 23, the man says, "This is now bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh." And the tone of voice is, "She's all right." She's all right, she is. That's all that means. Great. Good idea, God. Glad you thought of that one. And then verse 24, marriage, the lifelong faithful union of a man and a woman, one man with one woman, in marriage, is instituted by God. And there's no shame, verse 25. So far we've seen a world in which work makes sense, because it's got a purpose for looking after God's world, and in which sex makes sense, not simply that Adam and Eve should feel good with one another and enjoy passionate sex and commitment, but that the task of caring for the garden is one of joyful shared partnership, and the children that in God's purposes they have, the next generation and then the generation after that are to be brought up to know what the task is of looking after the garden. That's the picture. That's how it ought to be. That's a great picture. But it's not how it is, isn't it? I mean, you don't have to be a very perceptive observer of human affairs to recognize that that's not how it is. And if this story is God's story, then somehow it's got to make sense of the world as it is, which is what we come on to in Genesis 3. Because you look at this world, the extraordinary thing about this world is how in human beings there is tremendous dignity, cheek by jowl, with the most appalling depravity. It's not that we're all kind of uniformly, you know, sort of a little bit good and a little bit bad, in a kind of wishy-washy kind of way. It's that sometimes human beings are capable of the most fantastic love and devotion and sacrifice and brilliance and genius. But that stands absolutely next door to the most appalling brutality. That's the extraordinary thing that somehow needs to be explained. I'm told that on the Ettersberg near Weimar in Germany, there's a very old oak tree. And the story is that Goethe sat under that oak tree when he wrote what's apparently a very lovely work called The Wanderer's Night Song, a place of beauty and brilliance and creativity. And during the Second World War, that oak tree was enclosed in the grounds of the Nazi concentration camp at Buchenwald. Beauty and cruelty side by side. It's a picture, isn't it, of human life as it is. I don't know if you've seen the film American Beauty. I can't recommend it. Well, it's well made and acted. It's a deeply empty portrait of men and women. And it's evacuated of meaning. That's the whole purpose of it. And yet it's got the word beauty in the title. You see the irony of it. And we're meant to feel the irony of that. Sometimes it's true with brilliance, isn't it? Human beings can be very, very brilliant. but spoils. I haven't been sent a love letter from Mr. Barrock, as I'm told he's called. Have you read the papers today? An email telling me he loves me. Have you seen that? The email that's corrupted millions of emails through the world. Replicates itself, I'm told. Well, he hasn't sent me one, but I now know, because I've read the papers, to delete it if he does. But isn't it interesting that somebody who's obviously very ingenious, very bright, should dedicate his brightness to destructiveness and vandalism? It's a paradox, isn't it? And human beings, it's a bit like in a junkyard. You're walking in a junkyard and you see a rusty old bit of machinery and you have a look at it. And as you look at this rusty old bit of machinery, you realize that although it's broken, it has the marks of genius about it. You know, clearly this was a quite brilliant piece of machinery, perhaps some marvelous nautical chronometer or something. And you look at it and you think, somebody absolutely brilliant made this, but it's spoiled. That's human life as Genesis portrays it. 5 years ago, there was an earthquake, a terrible earthquake, in the Japanese city of Kobe. There were many deaths. And the next day, my newspaper said, searching questions were being asked about the fragility of some relatively new buildings. And I thought when I read it, you know, the really searching question is not about the fragility of buildings. The really searching question is why human life is so fragile. By a human life with all the possibilities of beauty and loveliness and achievement can be snuffed out just like that. That's the really searching question, like a candle in the wind. Well, Genesis 3 tells us why. So let's read it. Chapter 3, verse 1. The serpent was more crafty than any of the wild animals the Lord God had made. We're not told where he came from, but we're told that he was a creature. He's not another god. He said to the woman, he sort of sneaked up to her in a friendly kind of way, nuzzled up to her, and he said, do you want to talk about religion? Oh, yes, she said, I love religion. I love talking about God. He's a great God. Did God really say you mustn't eat from any tree in the garden? Sounds a bit mean. Oh, no, said the woman, verse 2, we may eat fruit from the trees in the garden, but God did say you mustn't eat fruit from the tree that's in the middle. You mustn't touch it or you'll die. Which is jolly nearly what he said. You won't die, the serpent said to the woman, verse 4. You can imagine the tone of voice, can't you? Fancy believing that, a grown-up girl like you. Surely it's not going to have those sorts of consequences, is it? You don't want to believe that. And then verse 5, God knows that when you eat of it, your eyes will be opened and you will be like God. Which is an irony, since Genesis chapter 1 has told us that men and women are like God. Knowing good and evil. God's just trying to stop you living a fulfilled life, that's what it's about. And then verse 6, when the woman saw the fruit of the tree was good, and so on, she took some and she gave some to Adam and he took some. So at the root of a spoiled world is not what we think of as sins, you know, sex and violence and that kind of stuff. At the root of a spoiled world is something personal. And it is that the Creator has given to human beings from the first man and woman onwards a command and a prohibition. I want you to love and obey me and listen. And we have decided, first man and the first woman decided, every one of their descendants except one in the succeeding generations, has followed their example and said, no, I do not want to live under his rule and his authority. I'm very happy to take the good gifts he gives. Isn't that right? God gives us many, many good gifts. I'm very happy to take them. Material possessions, brains, abilities, strength, friendship, love. Very happy to accept all of those. But I'm blowed if I'm going to live this life under his authority and his command. In the 1950s, there was an eccentric estate agent in London by the name of Roy Brooks. And he decided to sell properties by telling the unvarnished truth about them. And there was a famous series of advertisements he put in the Sunday Times. For example, one of them read, back bedroom suitable only for dwarf. Another one said, glum attic flat for midgets. But my favorite one was this. Of some house, he said, don't be misled by the exterior. It's worse inside. I thought that was great. That's a picture of human beings, isn't it? We need to say to one another, don't be misled by the exterior. It's worse inside. Because each of us has wanted to push God right out of the way. Some of us politely, some of us less politely, but that's what we've done. And that's the reason the world is out of joint. It has a deeper effect than we think, because human beings were meant to rule God's world. That's what mankind's meant to be doing. And when the ruler moves out of place and abdicates and rebels, the whole world goes out of joint. And we see that later on in the chapter. Verse 7, their eyes were opened, they realized they were naked, and in some ways shame came into the world where it hadn't been there before. Verse 8, they heard the sound of the Lord God as he was walking in the garden in the cool of the day, you know, coming for an evening walk to talk to them, as he loved to do and as they had loved to do. But what do they do now? Like, they hide. It's like a spider, isn't it? You turn the light on, scurries away. And then the Lord calls to the man, "Where are you?" Verse 9. He answered, "I heard you in the garden. I was afraid because I was naked. Fear comes into the world. So I hid." And he said, "Who told you you were naked? Have you eaten from the tree that I commanded you not to eat from?" The man said, isn't this interesting? "The woman you put here with me, she gave me some of the fruit and I ate. It's her fault." And the Lord God said to the woman, "What's this you've done?" And the woman said, "The serpent deceived me and I ate. It's not my fault, you see, I'm a victim." Very contemporary too, isn't it? I'm not a sinner, I'm a victim. It's not my fault. I'm a victim of my upbringing. There was some publicity a few years ago, actually, about a famous tennis player who'd become a drug addict, sadly. And one newspaper described him as a victim of cocaine. Interesting expression, isn't it? As though he was walking along one day and cocaine jumped out from a side alley and pushed itself up his nose. A curious description, very contemporary, isn't it? I'm a victim. Whatever it is, it's not my fault. Well, it was there from the beginning with Adam and Eve. And then verse 14 and verse 15, the serpent is cursed. And this is the encouragement in the chapter. See in verse 15, there'll be enmity between you, the serpent, and the woman, and between your offspring and hers. He, that is one of Eve's descendants, will crush your head, and you will strike his heel. And it's just a hint, just a little glimmer of light, that one day one of Eve's descendants will crush the serpent's head. Very vivid little glimmer of light, but no more than that. And then verse 16, very sad verse. To the woman he said, "I will greatly increase your pains in childbearing. With pain you'll give birth to children. Your desire will be for your husband and he will rule over you." Somehow sex, which made sense before, now it's spoiled. And now it brings grief just as much as it brings joy. Isn't that true? You don't have to be a very perceptive observer of human affairs to recognize that for all its promise, so often there's disappointment and grief. And it would be astonishing if in the families of those of us represented here this evening that wasn't evident. And then verse 17, work gets spoiled. To Adam he said, "Because you listened to your wife and ate from the tree about which I commanded you, you mustn't eat. Cursed is the ground because of you. Through painful toil you'll eat of it all the days of your life. It'll produce thorns and thistles." Verse 19, "By the sweat of your brow you'll eat your food." Isn't that sad? The glorious dignity of caring for God's garden, now it's become painful toil and sweat. And into human work there is introduced frustration of working and not achieving. There's introduced boredom, there's introduced exhaustion and disappointment. Isn't that true? Isn't that true that human work is that mixture of joyful fulfillment in a worthwhile task, and yet somehow always spoiled? And then verse 19 continues, "Until you return to the ground, since from it you were taken, for dust you are, and to dust you will return." And so human life becomes fragile, as it was in that earthquake. Isn't that true? Isn't that what it is? And the chapter ends with a terrible barrier. Verse 22, "The Lord God said, 'The man has now become like one of us, knowing good and evil, he must not be allowed to reach out his hand and take also from the tree of life and eat and live forever. Well, that's interesting. I don't know if that's a hint or anything. I'm drawing near the end. So, verse 23, the Lord God banished him from the Garden of Eden to work the ground from which he'd been taken. After he drove the man out, he placed on the east side of the Garden of Eden cherubim and a flaming sword flashing back and forth to guard the way to the tree of life. That's how the chapter ends, with a terrible barrier between human beings and God. Men and women who had walked in the garden with God in loving friendship and fellowship, now they're barred. Isn't this true? I remember as if it were yesterday, though it was about 20 years ago, a young man called George. I was a teacher in a school. He was a 14-year-old, and I was his maths teacher at the time. And he came to me at the end of a lesson, and he said, sir, it was a very respectful kind of school where they called you sir, and he said, sir, can I come see you and talk about some homework? So I said, fine, and he came to see me. And after asking about homework, he said, actually, that wasn't really the reason I came. Really, the reason I came is this. He knew I was a Christian. He said, it's not really about the homework. It's that I try to be religious. You know, I go to communion services and that kind of stuff. But I'm so conscious, I'm so aware that I always feel that there is a barrier between me and God. That extraordinary conversation. I'm so aware there's a barrier between me and God. It was like a deeply vivid reality to him, this barrier, and he wanted it to be broken down. And it was a marvelous privilege to be able to say to him, yes, that's exactly right, there is a barrier. The Big Apple, in the title of this talk, our rebellion against God. But, years later, that barrier was broken down when Jesus Christ, the perfect man, died on the cross to take the penalty, the punishment for our rebellion. And it was marvelous to be able just quietly to explain that to him and to explain to him how it's possible through turning from sin and trusting in Jesus Christ to come back into the presence of God. And very quietly and unemotionally he did that. I think he did that evening or the next day, I forget, and he told me later. About 20 years ago. He's been going on as a Christian ever since. Marvelous. But it all started because he said there's a barrier between me and God. I want to close by repeating the question that God asks in verse 9, chapter 3, verse 9. Would you just look back at that as I draw to a close? The Lord God called to the man, "Where are you?" Now, I haven't met you guys. I have no idea sort of where you are as regards Christian things. I imagine you're all sorts of different places. But it may be that there's somebody here, and you're conscious in your heart that you are seeking God, you're looking for God. You know other guys who seem to have a real relationship with God, and you'd love to find that. Well, let me tell you something. God has been looking for you long before you began looking for him. "Where are you?" he called to the man. Tomorrow morning in our church, no, not tomorrow morning, Sunday morning in our church, we've got a senior businessman who's recently become a real Christian, and he's going to tell his story. And he's told me some of it. Let me just tell you a little bit of what he's going to say. It's a very moving story. He tells the story of his divorce and of his misery and of business success, but a sense of emptiness in it all and of guilt. And then he says this. He says, "I suspect that God has called me towards him on numerous occasions, and I have managed to ignore him, too busy getting on with the important elements of life to listen. But like a true parent, he always tries again to bring back a wayward child into the family, and this time he has succeeded." Isn't that marvelous? "I suspect that God has called me. David, where are you? Adam, where are you? Eve, where are you?" It's marvelous truth to end on. That this terrible chapter, a barrier between human beings and God, has got that light in it, that God is asking, "Where are you?" looking for men and women. I'm going to stop there, and Not quite sure what happens then. Chris is going to tell us, is he? No, he's disappeared. Chris, you can tell us what happens now. I'll stop and hand over to you.